I had already signed a 3-year contract with NBC for the 1970-72 seasons and was making what I considered to be a fortune, $2,500 a week, with an additional raise of $500 a week annually. That didn't mean I was living high off the hog, as much of that money still went to support my family in Florida, but neither was I standing on a street corner with a tin cup. Since I had already signed this contract, Lee told me that he would not charge me the usual 10% agents traditionally took from a client's salary. During the term of the contract, he would represent me gratis. Should I go on to any new ventures, however, William Morris would receive its customary 10%. It seemed like a good deal to me, especially as I could not imagine having any new venture. So I didn't give money a thought when NBC came to me in 1971 and asked me to take over For Women Only, the local morning discussion show my colleague Aileen Saarinen had been hosting that immediately followed the Today Show. Part of the local NBC affiliate's public affairs department, it was a thoughtful program that attracted few viewers but provided the station with its proper FCC credentials. The Federal Communications Commission required all television stations to provide a certain amount of programming dedicated to the public interest or risk losing their licenses. The FCC list included children's programs, news, and, relevant to Aileen's program, public affairs. As NBC's cultural correspondent, Aileen invited intellectuals and academic authorities to sit on a panel and discuss what Variety described as a deadly serious and icily cold forum of pub affairs discussions. A small studio audience, experts on a particular subject who were invited to attend, was there to ask questions. Aileen's goal was certainly worthy, but not many women were ready for such an intellectual exchange at 9 a.m. Still, the program would probably have plodded along if, out of the blue, NBC had not offered Aileen a fantastic opportunity to go to Paris as its first woman bureau chief. Needless to say, she accepted. Sadly, she would die a year later of brain cancer. So now, her little morning show was adrift and floating around, was offered to me. This meant that, in addition to 2 hours of national broadcasting 5 days a week on Today, I would be adding to my schedule another half hour of local television. I was hesitant. How can I do all this? I thought. Will I ever see my husband or my child? Then I was told that we could tape all 5 programs in 1 day, because that would save the station a lot of money, as it would be my show to host and to book. Still, I hesitated. For weeks, I watched Aileen doing her show and decided that the premise was a good one, but that the subject matter could be broadened beyond local issues. We didn't have to deal with just a half hour on the city's water supply. We could discuss the hot topics of the day. Years and years later, this simple idea became one of the tenets of my ABC daytime program, The View. I asked NBC if I could broaden the subject matter and, to give the program a fresh start, if we could change the name from For Women Only to the rather cumbersome but I hoped more all-encompassing Not For Women Only. NBC agreed, and then I agreed to be the host. The inaugural broadcast took place in September 1971, immediately following the Today Show. I was worried that there would be more of Barbara Walters in the morning than the audience could bear, but the program was an almost immediate success. It isn't that I threw the baby out with the bathwater. I simply expanded the subject matter and reduced the purely public service format. When we did go the public service route, we tried to make the subjects more personal and more relevant to our audience, little by little, without making the program frivolous or reducing its intent to provide information, we changed it. Some changes were physical. To make the program more interactive, instead of seating the audience in neat little rows, I put them at round tables. This made the audience feel more relaxed and engaged with the panel. As a result, they were not afraid to ask questions or challenge assumptions. Furthermore, the audience was no longer just experts, but rather men and women who wrote in for tickets and therefore brought us people who asked questions the folks watching at home would most want asked. Though I didn't know it then, Not for Women Only would become the prototype for later women-oriented discussion programs hosted by the likes of Phil Donahue and Oprah Winfrey, and still later, as I've said, my own daytime program, The View. To make the program more meaningful, I tried to choose themes for the show that related to the lives of both the studio audience and the viewers at home. Is the family dying? Sensitivity training? TV and children? To name just a few. I threw in some lighthearted themes as well, like The Hostess with the Mostest, which examined the best ways to throw parties. We had a really experienced panel for that one. The very funny author and Washington hostess Barbara Hauer, newspaper columnist and hostess supreme Phyllis Cerf, wife of Bennett, and fashion designer Molly Parnas, then one of Manhattan's leading hostesses. They dished about what made a great guest and what made a great bore. It was name-dropping with a purpose, another forerunner of The View. I was delighted when the program took off. NBC was even more delighted. Their little local broadcast, buried in the morning before the hugely popular soap operas, was becoming a program to watch, and therefore a program to be sold to advertisers. My own schedule now was insane. The addition of Not for Women Only meant I not only had to prepare for the interviews I did for the Today Show, but for the varied themes of the new program. I had a wonderful producer named Madeline Amgott and a small staff of very hard-working women, but I still did a lot of the booking for Not for Women Only and wrote my own questions. The books and magazines piled on my bedside table reached life-threatening heights. Leisurely weekends became a distant memory, as did quality time with Lee. Why I drove myself so hard, I cannot imagine. Was it ambition? Was I afraid that my days on Today would not last forever? Was it money? It couldn't really have been the latter. NBC paid me only an extra $800 a week to moderate Not for Women Only, which came to $160 a program. I think it boiled down to the fact that I was grateful for the opportunity to prove myself once more. I had passed another audition. My past work in public relations was proving very helpful. Just as I'd learned that anything about sex in the lead of a press release caught the attention of its recipient, so also was sex a surefire seller on Not for Women Only. Whenever the ratings slipped, we did a program that dealt with some aspect of sex. I remember that for one full week, we explored female and male sexual dysfunctions. We had the most dignified and respected experts address these issues, and our questions were also dignified. But we managed to be candid and therefore exciting in a way few shows were in those days. For example, on one program, a sex therapist demonstrated how to discourage premature ejaculation by using a rolled-up towel to simulate a penis and showing the audience where to squeeze it. This was valuable information. Weeks later, I was on a shuttle from New York to Washington, D.C., when a young man approached me and asked me how hard to squeeze a penis. I was about to report him to the flight attendant until I realized he had seen Not for Women Only and was seriously asking for my expert opinion. After several months of taping 5 programs in one day, we cut down the exhausting schedule. We began to tape 3 shows on Tuesdays and 2 on Thursdays. But some of the panels, like the time we had the wives of Nixon's cabinet members, were important enough to run for the entire week. For those, we continued to tape all 5 days in 1 6-hour marathon. It was madness. The wives, Barbara Bush, husband George H.W. was then U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Adele Rogers, husband William was Secretary of State, Lenore Romney, husband George, headed the Department of Housing and Urban Development, Ann Richardson, husband Elliot, headed the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare, and Martha Mitchell, still more or less sane when her husband John was the country's Attorney General, arrived in the studio with their clothing changes on hangers so that each day a segment ran, they'd look different. We had a 10-minute break after each half-hour taping session, so everyone, including me, could change clothes. All of us chattered away and compared outfits. It was like being back in the dorm at Sarah Lawrence. Our efforts paid off. Within 6 months of the revised show's debut, the ratings tripled. NBC's Washington affiliate picked it up, for which I was paid an additional $300 a week. That's when Lee Stevens went to the brass at NBC and suggested that they syndicate Not For Women Only with Syndicast, a national media distribution company. NBC did, and within a year or so, the program was running in 80 cities. Thanks to Lee, I was making $5,000 a week from Not For Women Only, twice as much as I was being paid for the Today Show. NBC was turning a handsome profit as well. It's pointless to play the what-if game, but I could kick myself now for not asking to own a piece of Not For Women Only. Had I had my own production company then as I do now, Barwall Productions, I could have owned Not For Women Only and had a syndicated program that could have gone on for years. Just call me Oprah. I tend to exaggerate. Oprah, who is the best there is, established Harpo Productions Incorporated in 1986, which owns, produces, and distributes The Oprah Winfrey Show, the most successful talk show in television history, across this country and abroad. At last count, her program was being broadcast in 132 countries. She's one smart lady. Yet I'm not sure, as part of the news division, that I could have owned Not For Women Only. In any event, I didn't ask, and I didn't get. Being in the news division dictated a lot of what I could and could not do. It still does. For instance, the women currently on The View are provided with clothes every day if they want, and the designers are given credit, but not me. I can't, because as a member of the news division, I'm not allowed to accept gifts, and I can't give credit, which is seen as an endorsement. I almost always wear my own clothes when I'm on the program, or any program for that matter. I manage this with a lot of mix and matches. In the early days of the Today Show, when I needed a varied wardrobe, designers like Casper gave me samples to wear. I was a sample size back then, and Casper was a dear friend. Sometimes, if I liked a particular outfit, I could buy it at cost. I remember I once purchased what I now think of as a quite hideous outfit, comprising a purple plaid coat with two skirts, one the same purple plaid and the other a solid purple. I then bought two jackets, one plain purple, the other, once again, plaid. I could mix and match for days of ghastly outfits. I even found purple leather boots. I was the cat's meow, or rather, the cats all meowed when they saw me. I had other designers who were friends and either loaned me clothes or offered them to me at a reduced price. One was Halston, who was then the very hottest designer. All the socialites and movie stars of the time were buying Halston clothes. His muse was Liza Minnelli. Halston made me many mix and matches, a dark red coat with a dark red skirt and dark red pants for traveling, along with a beige skirt and a beige sweater to be worn with a dark red belt and the dark red coat. I took this whole outfit to Romania when the Today Show traveled there. I didn't need anything else. Halston was very expensive, but his clothes were so basic and practical, I wore them for years. Some of those pieces I still wear today, like the deep red pants with the matching coat, and this is more than 35 years later. I never wore provocative clothes on the air. None of us did in the news division. I wore suits or dresses with high necks and long sleeves. My body hardly showed at all, except for my legs and the miniskirt phase. It was an unspoken rule then that the only way for a working woman to be taken seriously was to be sexless. Things are much more relaxed now, but the basic rule for women anchoring news programs hasn't changed that much. We basically still wear suits. It's only in relatively recent years that I've begun to wear pants instead of a skirt for a serious interview. I distinctly remember one of the first times I did this, and it was to the White House, no less. It was in January 1996 when I was scheduled to interview First Lady Hillary Clinton about her new book, It Takes a Village. A fierce snowstorm had closed all the New York airports, but I was determined to get to Washington. I was worried that Mrs. Clinton, who was facing a new round of scandalous allegations about Whitewater, might not reschedule if I canceled. So I put on a pair of pants and snow boots and clumped myself to the subway to take the train from Penn Station. When we finally crawled into Washington, I clumped my way in knee-high snow up Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House. There was Mrs. Clinton, also wearing pants. I thought she might change for the interview, but she didn't. And for the very first time, she wore pants in an interview. She looked great. Mrs. Clinton is quite small on top, but rather large in the hips. The pants flattered her figure, and now one rarely sees Senator Clinton in anything but pantsuits. On an earlier trip to the White House, this one in 1970, the weather was kinder and my outfit far dressier. The dinner was formal, and I wore a black high-necked and long-sleeved dress. No big statement there. Washington is a very conservative city when it comes to fashion. Lee and I had been invited to a dinner for the great American painter Andrew Wyeth. I'd interviewed Wyeth the year before for Today, but the central character of this story was not Mr. Wyeth, but Richard Nixon. I hadn't seen the president in the 6 months or so since he'd persuaded both Prince Philip and Henry Kissinger to sit down with me for the Today Show, and I didn't know whether he'd even remember. But he did. When I jokingly thanked him for being the best booking agent I'd ever worked with, he laughed and said, "Who do you want me to get for you next, Barbara?" "Well, there is someone," I responded. "And who might that be?" he asked. "You, Mr. President," I said. The call came in from the White House almost a year later while Lee and I were packing to go on a mini vacation to Palm Springs. It was Ron Ziegler, President Nixon's press secretary. The president was ready to do an interview with me for the Today Show. Was I available? Lee and I started unpacking. For a television journalist to sit down for an exclusive chat with the President of the United States was quite rare at the time. Remember, there were only three networks. Fox, CNN, and MSNBC were still in the future. But Nixon was going into an election year with falling poll ratings, so I guess the members of his administration wanted to woo today's audience. And with reason. Nixon was seen as secretive, arrogant, and isolated from the public. His enemies had nicknamed him Tricky Dick, and a favorite poster at the time showed a picture of Nixon over the legend, "Would you buy a used car from this man?" The war in Vietnam that Nixon had inherited also continued to divide the country. Though Nixon was steadily withdrawing U.S. troops and replacing them with Vietnamese troops, he had also broadened the war in 1970 by invading Cambodia and Laos to cut off North Vietnamese supply lines. The resulting firestorm of protest on U.S. campuses had led to four students being killed by the National Guard on Ohio's Kent State University campus. The Nixon White House, particularly its designated mouthpiece, Vice President Spiro Agnew, was blaming the press and ideological eunuchs for the anti-war violence. My old friend and former boss Bill Sapphire, who was by then firmly entrenched in the Nixon administration as a speechwriter, came up with Agnew's famous description of the press as nattering nabobs of negativism, and topped that by denouncing any critics of Nixon's policies as hopeless, hysterical hypochondriacs of history. Alliteration games aside, it was a bitter time in America. There was no gray area. You were either a hawk or a dove. The patriotic mantra of Nixon supporters, the so-called silent majority, became America, love it or leave it. No wonder the White House wanted to project the image of a kinder, gentler Nixon to the public. The Today Show was the perfect vehicle. The interview, my first with the sitting president, took place in the Blue Room of the White House in March 1971. Nixon seemed very nervous as the camera crew set things up. He kept complimenting me on my knee-length boots.
"Those are very nice boots. They look very comfortable. Are those boots as comfortable as they look?"
When we finally got underway, I asked the usual questions about our involvement in Vietnam. and the president supplied the usual answers about not giving in to dictators. We could not simply cut and run, he said. Where have I heard that since? This was important information, but I felt that for our morning audience, it was also an opportunity to learn more about this secretive and remote man. After dealing with the foreign policy issues, I took a deep breath and said, Mr. President, there's been a lot of talk about your image and the fact that the American public sees you as rather stuffy and not a human man. I realized that I had just called the President of the United States stuffy to his face, and I could see his eyes narrow, but I plunged on. Are you worried about this image, Mr. President? Well, I'd opened a Pandora's box. The president went on and on about his lack of interest in his image and polls and press clippings that he professed never to read. Presidents who do, he said, become like the athletes, the football teams and the rest, who become so concerned about what is written about them that they don't play the game well. He warned that an elected official must not be constantly preening in front of a mirror, but should be doing the very best possible job he can do for this country, and that is what I'm doing. On and on he went, getting more dismissive of any public criticism. Anybody who takes his temperature with a Gallup poll, he claimed, isn't going to be a good leader. It made for a fascinating interview, a rare glimpse of the man's real personality. We ran the interview almost totally unedited, a precedent for 2 full hours on the Today Show. Today, you could never do that. The audience simply doesn't have the attention span. But times were different then, and there was great curiosity about Nixon's character. The interview didn't help Nixon's poll numbers, but it did enrage the other networks. The custom at the time was that a president never went on one network unless it was a pool broadcast for all 3 networks. But at that hour of the morning, CBS had Captain Kangaroo and ABC wasn't even on the air, so their complaints fell flat. It would be another 4 years before AM America would start, becoming Good Morning America 10 months later. As I was becoming more respected as a journalist, I was also, to my great sadness, becoming vilified by a man whom I loved as a performer and whom I thought of as a friend of the family. Frank Sinatra, no less, became a vehement and vocal enemy. For most of the rest of his life, he regularly complained about me publicly and ostracized me privately for the craziest reason. First, some background. I had known Sinatra off and on for years. He'd performed at the Latin Quarter back in the 60s when his popularity waned. At that time, he was particularly nice to my sister. I'd loved him for that. He'd even written her a sweet personal letter when she asked him for an autographed picture. Jackie treasured that letter all her life. My parents adored him, and although we had heard and read of the angry and occasionally violent side of Sinatra, we thought of him as a kind friend. Soon after I started on the Today Show, I re-met him at Phyllis and Bennett Cerf's country home, and he was more than nice to me. For example, he told me he would watch Today every morning for a week and send me his suggestions via Bennett. Frank Sinatra, that consummate performer, sending me suggestions? His first piece of advice, which I immediately took to heart, was that I was too deadpan when I did interviews, and that I should show more expression or reaction. I took his advice to heart and truly appreciated his attention. And then I made a fateful phone call. It all began one Saturday. Lord knows how I remember it was a Saturday, but I do. NBC News called me at home. There was a rumor going around that Frank was about to marry Pamela Hayward, the attractive widow of the well-known producer Leland Hayward, and the ex-wife of Winston Churchill's son, Randolph. NBC News, knowing of my relationship with Sinatra, asked if I could call him in California to check out the marital rumor. They didn't want to go with the story if it wasn't true. So I placed the call. I wasn't a gossip columnist, but I thought if I could tell the network what the story really was, both Sinatra and the network would appreciate it. Frank was out. I got his butler and left the message with a callback number. From that day, and for the next 30 years, Sinatra took a hate to me. I had invaded his privacy. I was no better than the worst gossip columnist, all of whom he despised. I wrote him a heartsick letter of apology explaining what had happened and asked Bennett Cerf to give it to him. Sinatra tore it up unopened. He would not only talk about me with disdain from the stage in Las Vegas, he wouldn't even be in the same room with me. At a tribute dinner several years later for Henry Kissinger, Sinatra, when he learned I was also to be seated there, refused to sit on the dais. Sad and embarrassed, the dinner chairman asked if I would mind not attending because Sinatra was such a big draw. That made me even sadder. Of course, I didn't go. My father and sister couldn't understand this one-sided ongoing feud and why the man they admired so much would behave so vindictively. I was hardly the only reporter to feel his wrath, but it hurt more because we had for so long considered him a friend of the family. Pamela Hayward did not marry Sinatra. She went on to marry Averell Harriman, a former governor of New York and a very wealthy man. After his death, she was very active in Democratic politics, and in 1992, she became President Clinton's distinguished U.S. ambassador to France. But long after her marriage and Frank's various marriages, Sinatra's enmity toward me continued. We finally, more or less, made up just a few years before he died. He was performing at a charity event for New York's premier cancer hospital, Memorial Sloan Kettering. The distinguished president and CEO of Sloan Kettering at that time was Dr. Paul Marks and, as I've told you, the husband of my friend from Sarah Lawrence, Joan Marks. Joan and Paul had remained among my closest friends for all those years, and Paul knew how much pain and embarrassment Sinatra had caused me. So he took a chance and seated me at his own table along with Sinatra and his wife Barbara. I held my breath, waiting for Sinatra to make a scene. But he simply acknowledged me with a nod and a brief hello. I'm sure by then he'd long ago forgotten why I had made him so angry 30 years before. Our one-way feud was finally over. But if I thought Sinatra's distaste for me was disturbing, it was nothing compared to that of the new man with whom I was about to share a desk on today. Exit Hugh, enter McGee. In the fall of 1971, to my surprise and sadness, Hugh decided to leave the show. He had been on Today for 9 years and wanted to spend more time with his wife in their new home in carefree Arizona. He had arranged with NBC to continue doing a series of specials on newsy, serious subjects that interested him, but unfortunately, the specials, though important, drew such small ratings that after a year or so, NBC discontinued them. Hugh's departure from Today left a huge gap. I was very sorry to see him go, but a good deal sorrier when his replacement arrived. We all thought Edwin Newman, a longtime NBC correspondent, would replace Hugh. Ed had often sat in as host during summer vacations. He had intelligence and a dry sort of humor, and he fitted right in. But evidently, NBC felt he was either too dry or too intellectual or too something and started auditioning other men for the job. Note the word men. Though I had been at the morning desk for 7 years by then, I was not even considered for the job of host, co-host, or any title that would give me a position of equality. I had been hired to fill the women's role on the program, and although I'd certainly expanded the parameters of the job, it was still the woman's role. If I left, another woman would replace me and the show would continue. The prevailing wisdom was not only that the men watching at home, but also the women, would never accept a female in an authoritative role. The host had to be a man. That man was Frank McGee, a respected journalist, a fine reporter and writer. Frank was personable, with a wide smile and a commanding presence on the air. He had everything going for him. Save for one thing, he hated our program. I didn't realize it at first. No sooner had Frank arrived than I left for Iran to cover the 2,500th anniversary of the Persian monarchy. Perhaps I was just too busy to pick up any negative vibes. I was swamped doing my homework for the trip and appearing on the Today Show and Not for Women Only, plus taping a whole other week of Not for Women Only to run in my absence. In retrospect, my ignorance of Frank's mood was probably good. I needed to concentrate on the upcoming Whirlwind Week in Iran. The Shah of Iran was throwing a huge anniversary party at Persepolis, the ancient desert capital of Persia. He had invited every king, ex-king, and head of state or government on the planet, and some 70 came, including the kings and queens of Sweden, Norway, Denmark, Belgium, and the Netherlands, Prince Juan Carlos of Spain, King Constantine of Greece, King Hussein of Jordan, President Tito of Yugoslavia, President Ceausescu of Romania, President Marcos of the Philippines, and his shoe-loving wife Imelda, and my old friend Princess Grace of Monaco and her husband Prince Rainier. There was even an emperor, the tiny ancient Haile Selassie of Ethiopia. His imperial title included Conquering Lion of the Tribe of Judah, who brought along his even tinier chihuahua, Chichibil, in a diamond-studded collar. Among the high-profile invitees not there were President Pompidou of France, President Nixon, and Queen Elizabeth. Though I didn't find out until later, there was concern about terrorist attacks. The first armed uprising against the Shah, which would end in the Islamic Revolution and his exile 8 years later, had occurred just a few months before the celebration, and others followed. Banks and movie theaters were attacked, police officials were assassinated, and just days before the gala, fundamentalist insurgents threatened to drown the Persepolis events in a bath of blood. Perhaps that was among the reasons President Pompidou sent his Prime Minister, Jacques Chaban-Delmas, President Nixon sent his Vice President, Spiro Agnew, and Queen Elizabeth sent her husband, Prince Philip, and daughter, Princess Anne. No one seemed to care about the safety of us journalists. If the list of Persepolis guests was newsworthy, the luxuries about to be heaped on them were even more so. The press was having a field day describing the over-the-top, lavish, air-conditioned blue-and-yellow tent city that housed the VIPs. Instead of keeping the theme ethnic and Persian, which would probably have been very charming and even meaningful, little in the tent city was Persian. It was wall-to-wall French. The tents had been designed by Jansen of Paris, the hot interior decorator at the time, who did everyone's chateau in France. His firm brought in custom china from France, Limoges bearing the Shah's family coat of arms, custom crystal glasses, baccarat encrusted with the imperial crown in gold, and linens, Portholt, the most elegant linen maker in Paris. Even hairdressers were flown in from Paris. So was the food from Maxime's. The only Persian touches were the handsome carpets on the floors of the tents, the hand-woven carpet portraits of each head of state, and the mounds of Iranian caviar, 2 tons, some said, for the banquet, which the chefs from Maxim's served with poached quail eggs. The lavishness and the emphasis on Western taste turned out to be a major mistake, though no one knew at the time just how great a mistake it was. While the Shah was trying to show the world how he was westernizing Iran, the Shia mullahs in Iran were slamming him for his infidel efforts. Ayatollah Khomeini, who would later lead the Islamic Revolution, was already pronouncing the festivities an evil celebration, and from his exile in Iraq, warning the Shah that an even darker future, God forbid, lies ahead of you. He was right, but we reporters didn't know that the Persepolis indulgences would become a major milestone in the Shah's eventual downfall and bring us the fundamentalist Islamic regime that exists in Iran today. We were there to cover a party. I was assigned to broadcast the Shah's homage to Iran's past, live from Persepolis. This was primarily a massive parade of some 1,800 troops in period costumes, along with assorted chariots, horses, water buffalo, and camels. The 2,500 years of pageantry were so promising that our program added an extra hour. That meant I would be on live for 3 hours. A challenge under any circumstances, and it became more so because no sooner did we arrive in Persepolis than my researcher-writer, Doreen Chu, got sick. Really sick. We were staying in students' dorms in the nearby city of Shiraz, and Doreen repaired to her bed, leaving me on my own with a 3-hour live broadcast ahead, no rehearsal, and no one to stand off camera and hand me research notes. Then, 2 good things happened. 1, I met a very nice male reporter from the BBC, whose name, sadly, I can't remember, who was also staying in the dorm. And I became friendly with Sally Quinn, a witty, very good feature writer for the Washington Post. Sally and I stuck together for the duration, comparing notes and sharing information. The hot water didn't work in the tents, the toilets were sluggish, the tents, all decorated differently, were absurd. Sally was reporting in print, I was reporting on television. Still, we were a big help to each other. It was my new friend from the BBC, however, who saved my life. When the show went on the air at 7 a.m. on October 15th, the viewer saw me sitting in a glassed-in booth facing the desert. From there, I described the horsemen, chariots, and floats going by. I seemed positively brilliant, rattling off the passing of every dynasty since 559 BC, including the Achaemenid, the Seleucid, the Parthian, the Sassanid, here's some more, the Tahirid, the Safarid, the Seljuk, on and on. What no one noticed, because the camera was basically on the parade, were the earphones on my head which connected me to my friend from the BBC. It's not that I hadn't done my own homework, I had, but I couldn't have mounds of notes in front of me with no one to sort them and be seen reading from the notes. My BBC pal, on the other hand, broadcasting for the radio, had all his homework in front of him and could read every fact. So much of what he said, I said, with my own additions 10 seconds later. I didn't say it quite in his voice, but there were times in the broadcast when I had a distinctly British accent. The problem was that the BBC did not have commercials, and we did. Every time I said, "We'll be back after this message," Joe Garagiola in New York appeared on the screen, at one point promoting Lipton onion soup, at another, Blue Luster rug shampoo. By the time the camera came back to Persepolis, my BBC friend was way ahead of me, and I'd lost at least a century of history. When we last left you, you could see the breakup of the individual remote villages in ancient Persia, I'd say. Well, now they have all been united, and it's no longer 1,000, but 1,100. Sometimes, if the commercial was a minute and a half long, or when Frank Blair read the news, the interruption was even longer, and we'd lose 500 years. I had to keep listening to my friend from the BBC so that when we came back, I could catch up and say, "As I was saying 500 years ago, what's a century here or there?" On the other hand, nobody much cared, because what the viewers were looking at were the horses and the costumes and the whole panoply of VIP guests we kept cutting away to. The viewers didn't care whether it was 2,500 years ago or last month. Did I send thank you flowers to my friend from the BBC when the last chariot passed by? Did I buy him a rug? I hope so. He literally made my day. For 3 hours, I was a distinguished authority, and live. I was a great success. The afterglow was short-lived, however. When I returned to New York, the party was over. Hugh was gone, and Frank McGee was about to make my life miserable. Frank considered his assignment to be a comedown. He'd been partly anchoring the evening news, one of the 3 rotating anchors who took over the highly respected Huntley-Brinkley report after Chet Huntley's retirement in 1970. NBC assigned him to Today when they decided too many anchors spoiled the broadcast and reduced the anchor slots to David Brinkley and John Chancellor. So Frank, naturally, felt diminished, and understandably so. McGee did not consider Today to be a serious news program. He was following Hugh Downs, who was, in his opinion, not a newsman, having been host of a game show. To make matters even more unacceptable for Frank, he was now being asked to share a desk, not with a male colleague, but with me, a mere woman, whom he couldn't possibly regard as an equal. Even the beloved Joe Garagiola earned his disdain during interviews on the set.
He asks questions I wouldn't ask out of professional vanity, McGee was quoted in a magazine article. On camera, McGee was pleasant and gave me a tight smile in the moments when we were casually chatting. The audience could not detect anything wrong. Off camera, he and I shared the makeup room, as Hugh and I had, and there he was distant, bordering on rude, and spent as little time in my company as possible. I could live with that because he was good for the show. The ratings were nearly as high as they were during the high points of Hugh's tenure, and that was enough for me. To Frank's credit, he did add some gravitas to the program by instituting a series of daily interviews from New York with Washington politicians or newsmakers. He and I sat side by side at the desk and asked questions in turn. But Frank couldn't stand it. He felt my questions were interrupting his questions and that his were far more important. The producer of the program, however, liked the two of us asking questions. He wanted to keep things as they were. The producer by then was Stuart Schulberg, brother of the acclaimed author of What Makes Sammy Run and screenwriter of On the Waterfront, Bud Schulberg. Since he wasn't getting anywhere with Schulberg, Frank decided to take action himself and went right to the top, to the president of NBC, Julian Goodman. He asked me to attend the meeting also, so that there could be no confusion about the decision. To my face, he complained to Goodman that my participation in these interviews reduced their importance. He felt that my role on the show should be restricted to, as he called them, the girly interviews. I could continue to sit at the desk, he said, but I was not to join in on the important and newsmaking interviews. Even as I write this, it is hard to believe that such an opinion would be expressed. But Julian Goodman did not seem to be shocked or disturbed. He listened to McGee present his case, and as if I were not in the room, he agreed. I couldn't believe this was happening. And even though, over the years, I had been grateful to accept any role I was offered, this was too much. I was nervous in front of these two formidable men, but somehow I summoned up my courage and found my voice. I told Goodman that I hadn't been on the program all those years and contributed all the interviews I'd done to go back to the era of the tea-pouring girl. I just couldn't accept his decision. And by the way, although I may have wanted to break down and cry, I didn't shed a tear. Looking back, I consider that day to be one of the milestones of my career. I cannot imagine what my future would have been had I just swallowed my feelings and restricted my work to the girly assignments. After my outburst, which seemed to have startled Goodman, we finally reached a compromise of sorts. Frank would get to ask the first three questions in the powerful person interviews. When he was finished, if there was any time left, I would be allowed to ask the fourth question. Moreover, Frank had the right to conduct any additional interviews he wanted to do without me. If a guest came into the studio for an interview and Frank wanted to do it, I would be excluded. I had absolutely no rights. From then on, I had to do whatever interviews Frank or Stuart Schulberg assigned me. Schulberg, who was not happy about the decision, reacted by having a three-martini lunch each day. We dealt with him mostly from dawn to noon. I, fortunately, or unfortunately, didn't drink. Not only did I realize that my fate was in McGee's hands, there was also the reality that NBC was paying Frank twice as much as they were paying me. I knew, in spite of the growing women's movement, that men were almost always paid more than women. This didn't surprise me or make me angry. It just made me feel insecure and replaceable. There were a lot of women who could sit there on the set and smile while Frank held sway and be happy to do the girly interviews. So I played my role as assigned in public and in print. I'm there to be there if Frank wants someone to turn to for help in an interview, I explained when asked about the situation. Though I remained superficially loyal and cheerful each day on the program, my new role was so unacceptable to me
that I looked for a loophole in the McGee Edict. I knew I couldn't come in until the fourth question, and I had no choice in the selection of the guests Frank wanted to interview on the set, but no one had said I couldn't go after my own important interviews and do them outside the studio. Stewart agreed. Therefore, that's what I did. And that's when I got the reputation of being ambitious and aggressive in pursuit of interviews, the pushy cookie. I was already reading 3 or 4 newspapers a day, as well as assorted magazines, to see who was in the news and whom I wanted to try to interview. I can't say I redoubled my efforts after Frank McGee's edict came down. I was already staying up far too late at night reading, making notes, and reading some more. But I began the practice of sending handwritten letters to the people I wanted to interview. I hate making phone calls. What I tried to do in the letters, and still do, is not to tell the people why I want to do the interview, but why they should want to do the interview. Do they feel they are being misunderstood or maligned? Would they like the opportunity to tell their side of the story? One of the prime examples was Henry Ford II. He had never given an interview on television, but he was being dragged into the news all over the country by Ralph Nader. Nader, a consumer protection environmental vigilante, had taken on the automobile industry in his 1965 book, Unsafe at Any Speed, and was attacking the Ford Motor Company for a variety of dangerous practices, like not installing airbags. He was also attacking Ford, as well as every other corporate CEO, for what he considered the single-minded pursuit of their company's profit margins at the expense of their social responsibility. So I wrote Henry Ford a first letter warmly suggesting, a second strongly advising, that he take the opportunity to express his own side of the story. Obviously, my letters got to him, for he decided to do an interview with me. I filmed it way outside our New York studio in Dearborn, Michigan, and getting him turned out to be such a coup that NBC ran it in separate parts 2 days in a row. I remember 2 specific things from that interview. 1, when referring to Nader's criticism about corporate profits, I asked Ford how much money he earned a year, and he replied, "None of your business." Good for him, I thought, although I didn't say it. I've often wondered why more people don't say that to me. And the second thing I remember was this great advice. Always give 1 excuse, never 2. So I stopped saying I couldn't come to a dinner party because I wanted to spend time with Jackie, and besides, I had a cold. 1 excuse, I've learned, works just fine, and you are much more believable. On and on I went, writing letters and making phone calls when it was time to close the deal. As a result, I managed to interview Trisha Nixon, the president's oldest daughter, outside the studio in Monticello, Virginia. The celebrated 90-year-old conductor, Leopold Stokowski, outside the studio in his apartment in New York, Cornelia Wallace, the young wife of presidential candidate George Wallace, at his campaign office, outside the studio in Alabama. Cornelia was of special interest because she had married Wallace, the segregationist governor of Alabama, just a year before an assassination attempt paralyzed his legs and left him in a wheelchair. I flew to Atlanta to interview Dean Rusk, then teaching at the University of Georgia, for that second interview with him, to Washington to interview the irrepressible and now seemingly not-so-sane Martha Mitchell, wife of the Attorney General, John Mitchell, and again to Washington on another occasion to interview the First Lady, Pat Nixon, at the White House. These interviews were getting a lot of attention from the press. Frank McGee wasn't thrilled, but they contributed to the high ratings of the show, so he really couldn't complain. Besides, in the studio, the almost daily interviews from Washington continued, and I, like the good, obedient girl, continued to wait to join in until the fourth question. One of the most newsmaking interviews I did took place in Washington in 1971, during the early McGee era. Everyone wanted to get to H.R. Haldeman, who had never done a television interview. Bob Haldeman was Nixon's crew-cut, seemingly cold-hearted and enigmatic chief of staff. Long hair and sideburns were all the rage then for many men, and Haldeman's retro-military hairstyle was a statement in itself. He was known as Nixon's Teutonic Guard, and many blamed him for Nixon's cold and isolated image. Haldeman's image was just as cold and distant, and it wasn't helping his boss. So I wrote and told him why he should want to do an interview with me. It wasn't because he hadn't done one before, or because it would show him to be warm and likable. Rather, I said it would be good for the president. Richard Nixon was getting a reputation of being a man with a brutal temper who really didn't care what people thought of him. I told Haldeman that only he could explain the president's philosophy and his reasons for governing as he did. I said that it was important for him, as Nixon's chief of staff, to present that more caring picture. I followed up with a phone call. I was encouraged when he took it. "You know, so much of your cold image comes from the way you look," I said, referring to his Germanic-looking crew cut and blue eyes. "People are beginning to refer to you as the White House Nazi." "I've heard that," he said with a laugh. "Haldeman, Achtung!" That was good. He was turning out to have a well-hidden sense of humor. After we chatted some more, he suggested I come down to Washington to further discuss the possibility of doing an interview. I was on the next plane. Haldeman and I had a pleasant meeting. He told me he would think over my request and get back to me. Later, I had lunch with Henry Kissinger.
"You're wasting your time," he said. "He'll never do it."
A month later, Bob Haldeman sat down with me in his office in the White House, definitely outside the New York studio. The resulting interview, which today ran in three parts on successive days in early February 1972, made national headlines. What turned out to be my seminal question was innocent enough. "What things, what kinds of criticism," I asked, "upset the president?" His answer was explosive. The Nixon administration at that time was attempting to conduct peace negotiations with the North Vietnamese, and not everyone agreed with their tactics. But in Haldeman's eyes, and presumably the president's as well, any people who were opposing what the president was doing were unconsciously echoing the line that the enemy wanted echoed. To drive home his point, Haldeman insisted that critics of Richard Nixon were consciously aiding and abetting the enemy. In short, they were traitors. I could hardly believe what I was hearing. It was an election year, I pointed out, and various presidential candidates like Democratic Senator George McGovern were critical of the president's Vietnam policies. Was Senator McGovern aiding and abetting the enemy? Haldeman wouldn't name names, but he didn't back down. He went on to decry Nixon's political opponents as people who put partisanship above peace and what needs to be done. Not very different from President George W. Bush's reaction to critics of the war in Iraq. The interview, although it raised a furor in the press, evidently pleased Haldeman, who sent me a warm note.
"Thank you for making me a household word," he wrote.
Despite the sorry behavior of Frank McGee and the president of NBC News, my job was going well. My marriage, however, was not. Marriage on the rocks. So that was the best of times. Interesting, provocative interviews, my reputation growing, but all the while, my marriage falling apart. This is, even today, extremely difficult to write about because there was no crisis, no abuse, no blame. This was simply, also, the worst of times. Lee and I had been married for 9 years. On the surface, to our friends, it was a successful marriage. We even looked good together. Lee would have made any woman look good. He was 5'10", very well built, with beautiful blue eyes and a warm smile. He was kind to me. I was kind to him. We adored our daughter. We were very pleasant to be with and had a growing circle of friends. In addition to our close friends like Anita and Warren Manschel and Joan and Paul Marks, my dear pals from college, we had become part of a very exciting world. We spent time with the celebrated composer Richard Rodgers and his elegant wife, Dorothy. Rodgers, who wrote the music for some of the greatest American musicals, from Oklahoma to South Pacific to the King and I, had a beautiful home in Connecticut. Dorothy was a perfectionist, and everything in her home was exquisite. Someone once said that when Dorothy Rogers peed, she peed flowers. Anyway, they both liked Lee and me, and from time to time, we would drive to their home on a Saturday and return Sunday after lunch. When you arrived, your suitcase was immediately unpacked and your clothes hung up or folded in tissue paper in the lined bureau drawers. I couldn't get over such luxury. Saturday nights, there was often a small dinner party with their friends who lived nearby. People like Walter Kerr, then the esteemed New York Times theater critic, and his playwright and author wife, Jean. She wrote the hilarious book, Please Don't Eat the Daisies. Or sometimes a star from one of Rogers' musicals, like Mary Martin and her husband, Richard Halliday. Lee and I loved those mini weekends. We would have gone more frequently, but we didn't like to leave Jackie and guests' children were not invited. There were other times when we would visit Bennett Cerf and his wife Phyllis at their equally beautiful estate in Mount Kisco, New York. Bennett had kind of a crush on me, and we used to meet occasionally for lunch at 21. I was fascinated by his stories of the brilliant authors his company, Random House, published. Bennett never made a pass at me, or even a suggestion of a pass. He just liked me and liked having younger people in his life. Phyllis, whom friends called the General, with good reason, she ran her husband's life, was used to Bennett's platonic crushes and made it a habit to incorporate them into their lives. At first, she sarcastically referred to me as Bennett's Mrs. Goober, but when Bennett invited me to lunch one day in the country and asked me to bring my husband, she was charmed by him. Lee and Phyllis became very good friends, and we were often invited to sparkling lunches or dinners. This would end when Sinatra, who was their most treasured friend, took his hate to me. I've already told you about that. But the point is that our times together, Lee's and mine, were just fine. The trouble was, there were too few times together, with or without friends. Lee's summer tent theaters were doing well, as was his year-round permanent theater in Long Island. But the musicals he put on and the special performances he presented, Tony Bennett, Johnny Carson, and others, meant that he had to spend most weekends, when the theaters did their biggest business, away from New York. I wanted to be with him, but I also yearned to spend what free time I had with Jackie, and I had so much homework to do for my crazy work schedule that traveling to Maryland or even Long Island was more headache than pleasure. Even on weeknights, Lee often had to visit one theater or another, and I couldn't go with him then either. He would get home long after midnight, I would be getting up 4 or 5 hours later. Our schedules began to resemble that of my mother and father, when he owned the Latin Quarter, and she saw him perhaps one night a week. There was another similarity to my father that troubled me. Lee wasn't satisfied just producing revivals in suburban theaters. He was ambitious and wanted to produce on Broadway. That was his goal. And during our marriage, he produced 3 shows on Broadway. One was relatively early in our marriage. It was called Catch Me If You Can, and featured a movie star named Dan Daly and Tom Bosley, the actor who would later play the father in the television hit Happy Days. Catch Me If You Can was sort of a comedy and sort of a mystery, but not enough of either to please the critics. It opened in March 1965 to lukewarm reviews and closed in less than 3 months. If Lee was discouraged, he didn't show it. Instead, he started looking for a new property to produce. That made me anxious. Producing on Broadway meant that he was often asking friends for money to invest in his productions. He said this was par for the course and the way things were done. And of course it was. Lots of so-called Broadway angels wanted to invest in shows, not just because they thought they would make a profit if the show was successful, but because they liked the glamour of being involved in show business. There is a saying that people have 2 businesses, their own and show business. I, of course, knew how unglamorous most of show business was, and wisely, Lee never asked me to contribute to his productions. His shows just brought back old memories of my father's failed productions. I dreaded reading the reviews and was demoralized when a play closed. Lee just took a deep breath and tried again. Lee's greatest challenge and greatest disappointment was with a musical version of a wonderful George S. Kaufman and Moss Hart comedy called The Man Who Came to Dinner. It had originally run on Broadway in 1939 and had starred Monty Woolley as an irascible, egocentric lecturer and critic who comes to a small town to speak, visits a local home, breaks his leg, and stays on and on, driving everyone crazy with his outlandish demands. The play was a huge success and in 1942 was made into a movie, again starring Woolley. His long-suffering secretary was played by no less a star than Betty Davis. Lee felt, with good reason, that it would make a terrific musical. Toward this end, he asked, begged, cajoled, and charmed George S. Kaufman's daughter, Anne, and Moss Hart's widow, the divine Kitty Carlisle Hart, to let him acquire the rights. After weeks of negotiating, they agreed, in part because Lee had a brilliant idea as to who should play the central character, the acerbic British actor George Sanders. Sanders, acclaimed for his caustic roles in The Moon and Sixpence and All About Eve, seemed just right for the part. He was said to be able to sing and dance. The book and lyrics were written by James Lipton, who later became the distinguished host of Inside the Actor's Studio, conducting interviews with actors on the cable channel Bravo. Lee's production of Sherry, as the musical adaptation of the play was called, was scheduled to debut in 1967. In addition to Sanders, the Betty Davis part was played by a woman well known to Broadway, Dolores Gray. She was tall, blonde, and sexy, with a big voice and a stage mother who had groomed her since she was a young child to get in front of the lights and belt it out. Belt it she did, and as a result, Dolores had starred in quite a few successful musicals. All in all, it seemed like magical casting. I was very involved in this production, more than in any of Lee's other shows. I knew how important this one was to him. I attended as many rehearsals as I could, wrote notes, and tried to be supportive, while disaster seemed to hit almost every day. Sanders, it turned out, was not playing an irascible grouch. He really was an irascible grouch. He was testy, argumentative, and sadly distracted by the serious illness of his wife, actress Benita Hume. He had previously been married to Zsa Zsa Gabor. He was late for rehearsals, if he showed up at all. He couldn't sing, had trouble memorizing his lines, and surprisingly his acting was dreadful. But everybody was still trying to make a go of it when the show arrived for its Boston tryout. Then his wife died, and Sanders walked out of the show. You couldn't really blame him, but it was a major blow. Lee valiantly tried to keep the production going. He replaced Sanders with a very talented actor named Clive Reville, who was actually much better in the part than Sanders, but was relatively unknown to the audience. Sherry opened on Broadway in March 1967 and ran for only 72 performances. It was devastating. Lee had had such high hopes for this musical, his most adventurous production. When the show closed, it took a lot out of him and a lot out of me. I felt that Lee needed me more than ever, but I had less time than ever to give. By then I was appearing on Today 5 times a week. But Lee, the optimist, like my father, jumped right back into the world of Broadway. 3 years after Sherry flopped, he produced a more ambitious and far darker play, Inquest, a dramatization of the trial of Ethel and Julius Rosenberg. It was a sympathetic portrayal of the couple who were ultimately executed for spying. It infuriated Roy Cohn, who had helped to bring about those executions. I saw Roy very rarely by then, and his reaction neither surprised nor disturbed me. But this drama, too, in spite of a fine cast that included Anne Jackson and George Grizzard, opened to poor reviews and lasted for only 28 days. Lee was heartbroken, and so was I. But for different reasons. Lee's involvement in the theater was driving me further and further away from him. It wasn't entirely his fault. It was the culmination of all the years with my father's grandiose schemes. The Broadway flops, the failed nightclubs, the aquacade that never got off the ground. I couldn't bear to pretend to be upbeat time and again while Lee read another bad review. I'd lived through enough openings and sad closings for a lifetime. But there was our little daughter. Jackie, barely out of her toddler years, had just started nursery school. Zell would take her to the small school in the morning, and I would try, as often as I could, to pick her up when her morning session ended at noon. Then we would go someplace for lunch. Schraft's was a favorite. It was a popular place for the grown-up ladies who lunched, but it also had great ice cream sodas and sundaes. Lee, too, loved being with his little girl. His older children, Carol and Zev, were off at college, and Jackie, for him, was a new beginning. He carried her on his shoulders, roughhoused with her, which she loved, and often took her to rehearsals of his shows, just as my own father had taken my sister and me when we were children. So there we were. A family, caring, but in distress. A family growing further and further apart, doing more and more things separately, not knowing how to come together again. Our disparate hours also affected our sex life. We practically had to schedule appointments to make love, and one or the other of us was usually exhausted. Both Lee and I were still watching our money. We continued to live in our rent-controlled apartment in Midtown New York. Jackie's room was actually a maid's room. Zell's room was the second maid's room. The apartment building had been built before World War II, when several live-in maids served one family. I was making very good money by then, but I was also still supporting my mother, father, and sister in Miami. Lee was feeling constrained because he had lost so much of his own money investing in his Broadway shows. But neither of us was a spendthrift. We rented a house only for a month in the summer, took few vacations, and cared little about possessions. Money was not the problem. Time was. But we never talked about that, or any of our problems for that matter. The conversations were unsaid. The problems were unresolved. I began to write goodbye letters to Lee, and then I would tear them up. How could I leave a man who had done me no harm, when our biggest mistake was that we had no life in common anymore? I didn't feel I wanted to reduce my workload. In fact, I had increased it by taking on Not For Women Only. Lee couldn't change his lifestyle or ambitions either. I decided once again that I was no good at marriage, and that basically the failures were my fault. Perhaps, like my mother, I was looking at the seams. I felt awful, but I didn't know how to make things better. Then in July 1971, the newspapers announced, to everyone's total surprise, that Henry Kissinger had made a secret trip to China, which had been closed to America since the communists had taken over in 1949. President Nixon, the headline said, was himself going to visit China. Unimaginable. Nixon's historic trip was scheduled to take place in February 1972. A small group of reporters was going to go with him. To my utter joy, NBC selected me to be one of them. I decided then that before I went off on this faraway adventure, Lee and I finally had to face our disintegrating marriage. Over a long and teary dinner, we decided to separate. At first, Lee wanted us to continue to try, but then he admitted that he was no happier than I. We decided that when I left for China in a month, he would move out of the apartment and find a new place to live. I would keep the apartment as it was home to Jackie. I was ending my second marriage. What was worse was that I was taking away from Jackie the daddy she loved. She was only 4 years old, and even though she would continue to see her father, it would never be the same. She had never met her biological father. Would she now feel in some part of her little being that her second father was leaving her too? But it was too late to change things. I began to pack for China and added another notch to my belt of guilt. Historic Journey, China with Nixon. President Nixon said the trip to Communist China, a week that changed the course of history, was like going to the moon. He was right. But though it was the trip of a lifetime, like Chinese food, it was both sweet and sour. And like the man in the moon, I have never felt so lonely. First, the sweet. The fact that I was there at all for NBC was to me a minor miracle. Because of the historic nature of the trip, the television networks sent their heavyweight, politically experienced superstars, Walter Cronkite, Dan Rather, and Eric Severide from CBS, Tom Jarriel, Ted Koppel, and Harry Reasoner from ABC. NBC was represented by its number one anchor, John Chancellor, along with two other very experienced correspondents, Herb Kaplow and John Rich, and me. Why me? One, because NBC didn't want what might look like competition between Chancellor and McGee, had he been chosen to go. Two, which I didn't find out until much later, because all the journalists from every network vying for the assignment were middle-aged white males. Dick Wald, the executive vice president of NBC News, felt that I might bring something different to the coverage. If nothing else, I would stand out to the viewing audience in contrast to all the male correspondents. And three, the time difference. 13 hours separate New York and Peking, as Beijing was then called. Nighttime in China is morning in the United States, when the Today Show would be on, the same time slot when I would be reporting from China on the night's big banquets, speeches, important toasts, and cultural events. The viewers of today expected to see me in the morning, and there I'd be, reporting live by satellite, albeit from the other side of the world. My inclusion in what was really a very small group of journalists ruffled a lot of feathers at NBC. For every reporter who got to go, 10 or more didn't. Even John Chancellor, I found out later, was against my assignment. I was relatively inexperienced, for starters, and a woman in a sea of experienced men. John would have been more comfortable with another male correspondent, but Dick Wald was determined to take the gamble, though he confessed to me recently he had fairly low expectations of what I would bring to the NBC team. Dick put my name on the NBC News proposed list, and the White House took it from there. The president's press secretary, Ron Ziegler, said he personally selected the traveling press corps out of hundreds of applications. I was terrified. Even the list of print journalists was intimidating, including William Buckley for the Washington Star, Theodore White, the Pulitzer Prize-winning author of the series The Making of the President for Time Life and Public Broadcasting, the prolific Pulitzer Prize-winning author James Michener for the Reader's Digest, giants all. There were very few women on the trip. One, in the president's entourage, was a very pretty young blonde with whom I would have a nodding acquaintance but no real contact. She was the assistant to Ron Ziegler, Nixon's press secretary, and her name was Diane Sawyer. There were only two other women journalists in the whole China group, the venerable and fearless UPI correspondent Helen Thomas and another very experienced journalist, Faye Wells, from Storer Broadcasting. Helen was writing for newspapers, Faye was reporting primarily on radio. I would be the only woman broadcaster. And with Frank McGee's backhanded blessing, "Get Barbara out of the studio for a week?" I learned later he'd said to Dick Wald when he heard of my assignment, "China's not far enough." It certainly felt far enough away for me when we arrived on our own press plane a day ahead of the president and his entourage. We were met by a small group of Chinese officials from the Department of Information, who all looked exactly alike. Both men and women were dressed identically in navy blue pants and Mao jackets, also navy blue, Mandarin collars, shapeless and unadorned, except for a round red pin with the silver likeness of Chairman Mao Zedong, the leader of the Chinese Communist Party and founder of the People's Republic of China. I was introduced to my interpreter, Miss Tang, who I later learned was married, but like all Chinese women at that time, she wore no wedding ring and used her maiden name. Miss Tang was serious and sullen. She always called me Miss Barbara Walters, never Miss Walters or Barbara. She started every sentence like this: And so, Miss Barbara Walters, today we will visit a factory. She wore absolutely no makeup, was 31, and looked at least 40. Her very first question to me was, "How old are you?" I answered that we were around the same age. We talked briefly about children. I told her I had a little girl at home who was almost 4. Miss Tang then told me that she had a daughter who was 2.5 and lived at a daycare center. She saw her on weekends. After this brief exchange, Miss Tang never expressed any further curiosity about me or Americans in general. Instead, she answered every question I asked, and you can imagine how many there were, as if they came from a political handbook. For example, when I asked her later if she could take me to a beauty salon, thinking that I might be able to find an interesting story there, she replied, "We have no need for beauty salons. We have loftier thoughts."
Take that, Miss Barbara Walters.
Even the arrival of the President of the United States attracted little curiosity and gave me my first anxiety attack. I was reporting from a makeshift studio at the hastily constructed broadcast center at the airport. All our live broadcasts by satellite would be made from there. None of us had been given any advance information about who would be in the Chinese meet-and-greet party or what ceremony there would be, if any. There we were, about to go on the air to report the historic moment to millions of Americans, without a clue as to what was happening. The answer was, not much. Only a small official delegation met President Nixon at the airport, one of whom was the 73-year-old premier, Zhou Enlai. In contrast, 4 months before, the Chinese regime had rounded up more than 300,000 people to greet the Ethiopian emperor, Haile Selassie. Mrs. Nixon was wearing the bright red coat we would come to know so well, the same color, ironically, as the large signs all around the airport calling the oppressed peoples of the world to unite and pay tribute to Marxism-Leninism and the Chinese Communist Party. Her coat and the signs were the only bright spots in the whole scene. The president's arrival was indicative of the tightly controlled doctrinaire atmosphere in China. After the brief welcoming ceremony at the airport, the Nixons got into a limousine with the Chinese premier and sped the 40 minutes or so into Peking, along empty streets. There were no curious crowds along Peking's Street of Perpetual Peace or in the vast 100-acre Tiananmen Square, the plaza of the Gate of Celestial Peace. 17 years later, hundreds of freedom-seeking students would be brutally put down by the government in Tiananmen Square. But when Nixon's presidential motorcade swept through it in 1972, the square was nearly empty and silent. There were just people on bicycles going about their business without even looking up.